Now stay tuned for the Le Show program from Santa Monica to around the world at the Sound of the Tone, 10 a.m. Interesting. Why, I told it to start and it stopped. Let's see if it'd do it again. Yeah, that's what it's doing. All right then, ladies and gentlemen. That's the auspicious way to end 25 years of broadcasting with the Le Show program. Yes, sometime this week, the official 25th anniversary, on the 3rd, the official 25th anniversary of this thing. And I think that's the best way to celebrate it. I know you've heard all the hype. You've heard all the, seen all the, well, there hasn't actually, because we're a quiet kind of, we're like that insurance company with a quiet company. That's us. But, of course, there's news about Pakistan this week, as there always is. But, you know, it was only a week ago that this broadcast shared with you that interview with the number 3 ranking guy at the Pentagon, who sort of admitted that the United States has been having concerns about Pakistan and the border areas and the terrorism thing. And so we had what happened this week. And you may have heard that the Pakistani government announced it was sending the head of its main intelligence agency, the ISI, to India to help, you know, with the investigation. Ironic, you would think, because according to one Indian intelligence official, the militants were using non-Indian cell phones and receiving calls from outside the country, which, you know, led some people to think, well, then there was some kind of involvement by some people outside the country. And this group, Lashkar-e-Taiba, I don't know, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly, which has been involved in terrorism in the Kashmir deal, has received some training and logistical support in the past from, guess who? Pakistan's powerful spy service, the ISI. Maybe a good reason why the Pakistani government announced the director of the ISI is not coming to India to help with the investigation. Instead, they're sending a representative instead. Ooh, look out. That's all I can say. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, a good reason to keep the Los Angeles Times afloat. This story. This week. The United States war on drugs has failed. No! Really? Thank you, L.A. Times. Thanks for staying alive in order to tell us that. And we'll continue to do so as long as it emphasizes law enforcement and neglects the problem of consumption. This, according to a Washington think tank, in a report co-chaired by a former president of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo. He says our policy has been asymmetrical in demanding that countries such as Mexico staunch the flow of drugs without successful efforts to stop the flow of guns south. Hey, now you're talking about the Constitution, senor. And another media organization well worth keeping alive, Clear Channel. According to, I believe this was in the New York Times, is deteriorating fast. Now, revenue in its radio segment is falling, down 7% in the third quarter, operating income down by 20%. Citigroup reckons that Clear Channel's debt will rise to a crushing 12.5 times cash flow sometime next year. That's the pot calling the kettle black. If Citigroup says you're in trouble, babe, you are in trouble. You know, maybe they should sell that billboard wing, or at least tell that billboard wing to accept you know, anybody who wants to advertise on it instead of exercising political censorship. And, ladies and gentlemen, now that the United States has signed and had approved by the Iraqi parliament an agreement with a timeline for the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq, no, we're never going to do that. Here comes Afghan President Hamid Karzai, sharply criticizing the United States and NATO and demanding a timeline for the withdrawal of the foreign troops. He was talking to a UN Security Council delegation in Kabul. He accused the international community of failing to fight the Taliban properly since the U.S. invaded way back in 2001. This war has gone on for 7 years, he says. The Afghans don't understand anymore how come a little force like the Taliban can continue to flourish, can continue to launch attacks with 40 countries in Afghanistan, with entire NATO force in Afghanistan, with the entire international community behind them. Still, we're not able to defeat the Taliban, Karzai said. Oh, by the way, he's running for re-election next year. Hello, welcome to the show.
Lots of folks back east, they say, leaving home most every day, beating the hot old dusty way to the California line. Cross desert sands they roll, getting out of that old love hole. Think they're coming to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 per day.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this, the final broadcast in the 25th year of Le Show, the show disservice to the community. We begin year 26 next week. Yeah, I know, you've read all about it. Ladies and gentlemen, but here's something you haven't heard. We don't have a very large news outside the bubble section today, but this is definitely from outside the bubble. Remember last summer when there was that battle between Russia and Georgia, the nation of Georgia, not the state. Russia has not come to Atlanta and burned it yet. Remember that? And John McCain was a big supporter of Georgia, took its side, said this shows how nasty the Russians are. No connection at all to the fact that his foreign policy advisor was a lobbyist for the nation of Georgia. That's so beside the point. That is, we're looking forward. So here we go from the Times of London this week. I don't think it made it through the curtain. The Prime Minister, Saakashvili of Georgia, admitted this week that it was Georgia that began military operations in the breakaway province of South Ossetia, not Russia, as had previously been claimed by the Georgians. But he said it was in response to Russian provocation. They looked at me funny. Meanwhile, Georgia's former ambassador to Moscow, this also according to the Times of London, blamed Saakashvili, saying, quote, Russia was ready for this war, but the Georgian leadership started the military action, unquote. No word yet from John McCain or Sarah Palin or Joe the Plumber. I think he was pro-Georgia, too. And while the Democrats have welcomed Joe Lieberman back into their fold, Dateline Dateline Kansas. A Johnson County committeeman has sued the Republican Party Central Committee for barring him from voting at a meeting because he gave $100 to a friend who ran for office as a Democrat. Another committeeman was barred from voting because he contributed to the campaign of his Democratic wife. Yeah, well, let's look forward, shall we? That's looking back. Let's look forward. And now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
The award-winning news of the warm.
We can listen to the warm.
Well, it's not often we report good news associated with climate change. Warming temperatures, though, could give welcome respite to farmers in China, at least, by suppressing locust plagues. Zhibin Zhang of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and his colleagues have trawled through 1,000 years of historical records documenting locust swarms and compared it with 1,000 years of temperature, drought, and flood estimates. They found the Oriental Migratory Locust, one of the most damaging agricultural pests in Chinese history, operates on a climate-driven cycle. Every 160 to 170 years, the swarms get bigger, then subside again. Counterintuitively, the timing of the largest swarms coincides with cooler periods. Popular view is that global warming may accelerate natural and biological disasters like drought and flood events and outbreaks of pests. Our results, says Zhang, suggest that warming reduces climatic extremes and locust plagues, or at least it did in ancient China. On the other hand, from the Independent newspaper, global warming is forever. Some of the world's top climate scientists have concluded their research shows that carbon dioxide emitted from today's homes, cars, and factories will continue to heat up the planet for hundreds of thousands of years. Grain of salt time. Their findings, which contradict a widespread belief that the atmosphere would recover quickly once humanity stopped polluting it, come at the beginning of the most crucial week for the climate this year. Britain's powerful climate change committee tomorrow will lay out a roadmap to put the country on track to slash greenhouse gas emissions. The new research comes as a shock because most governments and even scientists have assumed that carbon dioxide emissions would work their way out of the atmosphere in about a century. One of the main researchers of this new stuff, Professor David Archer of Chicago University, warns that the climatic impacts of releasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide into the atmosphere will last longer than Stonehenge. No, I figured you'd do it. Longer than time capsules, far longer than the age of human civilization so far. Ultimate recovery takes place on timescales of hundreds of thousands of years, a geologic longevity typically associated in public perceptions with nuclear waste. Unquote. Carbon dioxide mainly leaves the atmosphere by being soaked up by the oceans, but Professor Archer says the pervasive notion in the climate science community and the public at large that this happens relatively quickly is no longer valid. The ocean is getting fed up with absorbing CO2, he says. The surface waters, which used to sop it up, are now getting saturated with it, turning acid in the process, and so decreasing their uptake. They need to be replaced with fresh water from deep down, but this overturning circulation takes centuries or a millennium. All right, then. Big ocean flushers. Come on. Come on. We can do it. We're America. We build. No, we don't. And global warming is expected to slow the circulation of the oceans down. The hotter the surface layer becomes, the longer the replenishment takes. Uh-oh. I'm saying ocean flushers. Come on now. Get to work. It's the weekend. Indeed, research shows that even this renewing process will not be enough to remove all the vast amounts of CO2 that humanity is now adding to the atmosphere. Much of it will have to wait hundreds of thousands of years before being removed by another infinitely slower process, the natural weathering of rocks. Yes, I'm going to stick around for that. That incorporates the gas into other substances. The more pollution that is emitted now, the worse this will become. Research by another of the paper's authors adds another alarming twist to the story. Professor Ken Caldera of Carnegie Institute for Science in California was surprised to find that even after the pollution stops, the Earth's temperature will not start to fall, but will settle at a new higher level. Just slowing down emissions is no solution, says James Hansen of NASA. Instead, some of the fuels must be left in the ground forever, and that the gas must actually be removed from the air by growing trees, which soak it up as they grow, and then burning them to produce electricity and capturing that gas before it is emitted. He also proposes no more coal-fired power stations be built. Good night. Oh, and climate change researchers and the agencies that fund their work should cut their own carbon footprint, says an atmospheric scientist who has calculated the carbon emissions of his colleagues. It's cute. It's from Nature. Andreas Stoll examined all the work-related emissions of his fellow researchers at the Norwegian Institute for Air Research. In the last couple of years, he found that travel alone led the scientists to contribute 4 to 5 tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere per person per year. Most of these emissions came from airplanes the researchers boarded to hop around to meetings and conferences on 24 days a year on average. What, they don't have Macs? The figures are not unusual compared with business professionals or scientists in many other fields. But Stoll believes climate change researchers should set an example. The way they're funded makes this difficult. In Norway, as in other countries, we have funding programs, he says, where we're encouraged to have colleagues in the United States. And, of course, you have to meet. So the funding structure really encourages travel. All right, then. The world's forests and the billion people who depend on them are facing devastation from climate change unless we evolve with the changing situation, according to a new report from the Center of International Forestry Research. Concluded that climate change will have a dramatic effect on forests, irrespective of any future greenhouse gas emissions. Within the next 100 years, tropical regions are likely to heat up at a faster rate than the global average. Rainfall in the summer monsoons will increase in some areas, while annual rainfall will decrease in others. Tropical cyclones may become more severe, and droughts, floods, and wildfires are likely to be more common. Unless immediate adaptive action is taken, says lead author, these changes will lead to a self-perpetuating cycle where destruction of the forests leads to an increased amount of carbon in the atmosphere, which will in turn cause further climate change. Two suggested categories of adaptation. One, improve fire management to reduce the risk of uncontrolled wildfires or the control of invasive species. And two, help forests evolve toward new states better suited to the altered climate. I don't even know what that would mean, and he doesn't say. And finally, news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Well, just think about the good news. Fewer locusts. But climate change and a starfish outbreak have shrunk coral reefs near Fiji, forcing locals to change their lifestyle. A new study published in Global Change Biology has found that from 2000 to 2006, the size of coral reefs around Fiji's remote Lau Islands contracted by about 50%. Fishing and habitat disturbance are having a big impact. The area was disturbed by a crown of thorns starfish outbreak in 2000, and then there was a coral bleaching event associated with climate change. Yeah, I know. First the coral starts bleaching, then they go to Botox. It's just an irreversible process. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now let's catch up with one of the worst of the worst.
But I found a driver and that's a start. Baby, you can drive my car.
Salim Hamdan, the former driver for Osama bin Laden, who was convicted, of course, at the first Gitmo trial, will serve the rest of his sentence in his native Yemen. You may recall at the end of his trial, a military jury refused to convict Hamdan on the serious charges. His judge then decided to take into account the time that Hamdan had already served since he was first charged, 5.5 years, so he was eligible for release by the end of the year. Furious at the result, the Defense Department resorted to claiming that the judge was not entitled to reduce Hamdan's sentence for time served and called for the jury to be reconvened. The judge dismissed these claims in a terse judgment at the end of October. If confirmed, Hamdan's transfer to Yemen to serve the last month of his sentence will bring to an end an ugly rumor that the administration failed to quell at the time of the sentence, the suggestion that if the authorities so desired, they could continue to hold Hamdan as an enemy combatant even after his sentence was completed. We got him. We're sending him to Yemen. He's going free. Osama bin Laden's driver, ladies and gentlemen. That's a start. That is a start. This is Le Show. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time to catch up with what's been going on in Iraq. Because things are going so well, don't you know? Yes, you do. You've heard that. An Iraq amnesty law that has undermined efforts to prosecute Iraqi government officials for corruption. The corruption has cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars. Iraq's parliament enacted the amnesty law in February, eliminating the charges, convictions, or investigations of all Iraqis except those who committed, you know, certain serious crimes such as murder or terrorism. The law was an effort to help bring reconciliation to the feuding religious, ethnic, and political factions within Iraq. So we've brought our concept of accountability to Iraq. Job well done. Sure, we're looking forward. Look backward? That's for Afghans. As a result, 690 corruption cases handled by Iraq's Commission on Integrity have been dismissed. That's according to the Special Inspector General for Iraq. The decision to forgive this many people for corruption in the last 3 or 4 years, that's unacceptable, says Abbas Mehdi, a Minnesota college professor who served in 2006 and 2007 as a top advisor to Prime Minister Maliki and as head of Iraq's National Investment Commission. People who stole the money should be accountable, he says. Yeah, they had their accountability moment. It was November 2004. And that's when George Bush had his. About $18 billion, more than half of it our money, U.S., has been lost to government corruption and waste in Iraq since 2003. Al-Maliki's spokesman did not respond to repeated efforts to get a comment. The United States has little recourse when U.S. funds are misused by Iraqi official, since Iraq's courts handle those corruption cases. See, they're sovereign when it counts. In addition to the amnesty law, pre-invasion statute allowing cabinet ministers to block investigations at their ministries have hobbled anti-corruption efforts. All right. Job well done. But about that agreement, the so-called Status of Forces Agreement, the SOFA, that was agreed to by Iraq's parliament this week, although the chief Shiite, can I say that on the radio? Clergy person in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, has now been making grumbling noises about the agreement. It will be sent to the Iraqi people in a referendum. But according to McClatchy News, according to Jonathan Landay and Nancy Youssef at McClatchy, who were right all along in the run-up to the war, unlike your newspaper and mine, the Bush administration has adopted a much looser interpretation of several key provisions of that agreement than has the Iraqi government. See where this is going? These include a provision that bans the launch of attacks on other countries from Iraq. Well, we wouldn't have no need to. A requirement to notify the Iraqis in advance of U.S. military operations, and the question of Iraqi legal jurisdiction over American troops and military contractors. Aside from that, we agree. Officials in Washington told McClatchy papers that the administration has withheld the official English translation of the agreement in an effort to suppress a public dispute with the Iraqis until after the parliament vote. That's nice. That's considerate. You know, why have a wrangle in public? It's so unseemly. For friends, there are a number of areas in here where they have agreement on the same wording but different understandings about what the words mean, says a U.S. official who requested anonymity because he likes his knees right in the middle of their legs. You know, we thought Bill Clinton was a master at parsing. The Sunnis want the U.S. to refrain from implementing wording that they consider vague, though they declined to say which passages concerned them. In some areas, three officials told McClatchy the U.S. and Iraq have agreed on the words but have different interpretations of what they mean. The administration had planned to release the official English language text last week, but instead designated it sensitive but unclassified. I believe that means that not even Dick Cheney can look at it. We plan to release it soon, says a spokesman for the National Security Council. We're waiting for the Iraqi political process to move further down the road, i.e., when it's too late. A U.S. official says the aim was also to head off any debate in the U.S. media. The administration fears that any discussion may inadvertently throw this thing off the rails, said the official. That's the way you run a democracy. Well, I know, we're getting used to it, haven't we? The Iraqi parliament began distributing an Arabic version of the document nearly 2 weeks ago, and Iraqi television has been broadcasting excerpts this week. McClatchy's Baghdad Bureau last week produced an unofficial English translation of the agreement based on the Arabic text. Specialists who follow the Iraq War said they were aware of the differing interpretations. The two agreements, says one think tank operative, have agreed to punt together on a number of important issues, which we mentioned earlier. So, nice people doing nice things. Meanwhile, yes, George W. Bush is still president, in case that didn't make it clear to you. He was last weekend at his final international meeting, the APEC summit down in Peru, and there was a photograph of him. Well, there were several photographs. Of course, they always wear funny clothes at the end of that meeting, and this year it was the brown poncho. The brown poncho look. Oh. And but there was another more newsworthy photograph from that meeting. The hoisting of a cocktail. Peru's national drink, Pisco Sour, promoted by Peru at that photo op. Peru's environment minister was proud to note that the drink was well accepted by international guests, including Japan's Prime Minister Taro Aso, about whom more later. Pisco Sour has been the star of the APEC summit, he said. U.S. President Bush, who quit drinking at 40, was apparently drinking a Pisco Sour during that meeting. It's a cocktail containing Pisco, a Peruvian brandy, as well as lemon juice, egg whites, syrup, and regional bitters. Ugh, ugh. And speaking of the president, in an interview conducted for StoryCorps, by his sister, he opened up a little bit, started getting a little reflective, which you know he hates. His sister, Doro Bush Koch, asked him, "How do you want to be remembered?" And he admitted he'd forgotten the question. No, he didn't. Come on now. Stop that. And what were you most proud of? He said, "I came to Washington with a set of values, and I'm leaving with the same set of values. I'd like to be remembered as a person who, first and foremost, did not sell his soul in order to accommodate the political process." He was also asked, "I'd like to be a president known as somebody who liberated 50 million people and helped achieve peace." Yeah, well, we'd all like that. "I'd like a new bicycle." Koch asked Bush to describe the influence of their parents. "I think the gift our dad gave to all of us is unconditional love," George W. Bush said. "It is the greatest gift a father can give a child. And he also taught me that you can go into politics with a set of values and you don't have to sell your soul once you're in the political system." A reflective tone for George W. Bush. May have been followed up by a phone call.
Thanks for legal.
Hey, 43, that was Thursday's code name. Secret Service taking the weekend off?
No, I told the code people we could ride with that one till Monday. You know, part of my legacy is having the Secret Service on my side. You remember what they did to Clinton just because he treated them like the help.
Well, hope you didn't give the help the weekend off.
Journalists and historians don't talk to them.
Yeah. Anyway, Sprout, just wanted to call and thank you for the nice things you said in that interview with your sister.
Well, you know, had to say something.
Know that it's sometimes... a little hard for any of us bushes to express our feelings out loud or otherwise.
Well, you know, it was no big deal. She just asked me about your influence on me, and
you didn't start in about all the mistakes I had supposedly made as president that you were going to rectify. Appreciate that. I guess you'd call it humility.
Well, of course, I never said I was going to rectify anything. I don't even know what that means.
Suppose history has kind of ended up showing that your old man didn't screw up quite as badly as you thought. Had a recession, sure, but nothing like this. My war in Iraq was over before the basketball playoffs were. Guess time has brought you to certain realizations about...
I thank you for the love, 41. I wouldn't push it. I'm still very proud of my legacy as a liberator.
Liberated the Kuwaitis on my watch.
Half a million guys in suits. Dear Father, I've liberated two huge countries, and you know, we still got to January 20th, so the final totals aren't in yet. You know, watch this space.
Reading that Afghan women are staying home again now that the Taliban are getting stronger. Is there a legacy deal for temporary liberation?
See, we got the Iraqis to agree to an agreement they don't even understand. You know, you want to talk about diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we got the right to keep liberating them for as long as we need to.
Iraqis take a lot of liberating.
Yes, they do. It's an unliberating neighborhood.
Mm.
But, you know, 41, proud of standing by my principles, told the voters I'd restore dignity to the Oval Office, and I've never once gone in there without a tie on.
No, son, think history's going to give you that one.
Well,
just think we're getting to the point where maybe some other feelings can be expressed.
Yeah, me too. You're going to miss Air Force One. You know, no crowds.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I pardoned my last turkey. Always got a kick out of that.
Just thinking that this whole idea of trying to, quote, fix my mistakes, unquote, you know, maybe time to retire that old chestnut.
You know something? This reminds me of that afternoon I beat you at Horseshoes for the first time. Hearing the same edge in your voice. Tell you something, 41. There's an old saying, history is written by the historians. But if I didn't believe that the good Lord himself is writing the history of this country and that he's including a pretty good chapter on his humble servant from Crawford, Texas, if I didn't believe that, then that cocktail I drank at the APEC conference in Peru, it would sure as heck has had alcohol in it.
Yeah. Saw that photo. You know, you got off lucky just wearing a poncho. One year at that APEC deal, we all had to wear blue muumuus. Ugly. And drafty, too.
Yeah, and you know, I think the good Lord will give due weight and height to the fact that I've kept the enemy from attacking America again since 9/11.
Son, never said this to you before. Not saying it to you now, but it might have been even more helpful preventing them from attacking America on 9/11, too. Well, and, you know, had that even been possible, which there's obviously debate about. Now, of course, it's spilt milk, but our friends in India know
you
what...
You know, it's like Dick Cheney says, democracy is not about winning a popularity contest. So, you know, I feel liberated, speaking of which, by not having to look at the kind of poll numbers we're getting. You know, that in and out itself tells me that we're on the right track. I mean, you know, have to break some eggs to make scrambled eggs.
You thinking of delivering a speech on the economic thing anytime soon, or you're just going to let the next guy take over right now?
See, we're trying to have as part of our legacy the best transition ever. Dick says that that's going to help focus people on something other than the pardon. So, you know, if Rush Limbaugh is already calling it the Obama recession, maybe we still know what we're doing over here, 41. Still sprinting to the finish line. Of course, real legacy is in the executive orders. Good Lord's hard at work on those right now.
Suppose I should. should be grateful. They're just undoing Clinton stuff, not mine.
Yeah, mostly. But look, 41, I meant what I said about the unconditional love. You know, I think it's great. Anytime you want to start it up, be fine with me.
Well, appreciate the kind words, 43. Barbara did too, of course.
Please tell her you send her my best.
Will do. Well, I guess those other feelings can wait. So long, 43.
Yes, sir. You take extra good care, 41.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week, Silver Jubilee edition.
we're so sorry.
This from Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, so you know it's got to be true. Merry Hanukkah from the White House. The president and the first lady invited leaders of America's Jewish community for a Hanukkah celebration at the White House, but raised more than a few eyebrows by putting a picture of a Christmas tree on the invitation. Oops. The incongruity of the message did not go unnoticed. When reached for comment, Laura Bush's spokeswoman, Sally McDonough, said the White House usually prints separate cards for the different religions. But in the waning days of the presidency, there had been an oversight. Sprinting to the exit. Quote, Mrs. Bush is apologetic, she said. It's something that just slipped through the cracks. Boy, that's the epitaph for the whole gang. Dateline Los Angeles, Gwyneth Paltrow has apologized to animal welfare group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals for inadvertently wearing fur in an ad campaign. She angered the organization after she graced the ad of an Italian shoe company wearing a fox stole. Well, if the fox stole, what? Oh, sorry. The PETA released a statement saying Gwyneth Paltrow won't be the apple of her daughter's eye if she continues to flaunt fur. Paltrow was apologetic when PETA's senior vice president saw her over the weekend. The actress said, that was awkward. I'm glad you asked because I do not wear fur at all. It was a day-long photo shoot on a boat near Capri, and there were all sorts of poses with all kinds of clothes. None with fur. During one setup, a stylist came up from behind and draped a stole around my shoulder. I didn't pay much attention to it, and when I noticed it was fur, I assumed it was fake fur, but did not ask, so it's my fault. Michael Vick opened the door to a possible early release from federal prison this week by pleading guilty to a Virginia state charge for his involvement in dog fighting, a necessary step in his quest to return to the NFL. Go, dog! I want to apologize to the court, my family, and to all the kids who looked up to me as a role model, Vic told the judge during Tuesday's hearing. He arrived shackled, but the restraints were moved before the hearing. Now back to that Japanese Prime Minister, Taro Aso. He leads the world's fastest aging nation, has condemned Japan's elderly as a bunch of hobbling malingerers. Aso, who is 68, says, I pay my taxes, so why should I pay money for people who laze around eating and drinking and never do anything? Members of his own party said the attack was completely irresponsible in a country where one in five voters is more than 70 years old. And a general election is coming up. Some believe the comments were entirely predictable given Aso's penchant for inappropriate remarks. His attacks on old people for their lack of exercise and for, quote, always tottering off to the doctor, unquote, was blurted out during a ministerial meeting on the economic crisis. Probably the most spectacular gaffe of a political career strewn with increasingly baffling clangors. Doctors, he said recently, tended to lack common sense. Japan, he declared on another occasion, should make itself attractive to rich Jews. He was once made to apologize for a joke about people suffering from Alzheimer's and quipped to victims of a flood that it was lucky for everyone that the city nearby had not been hit. He briefly apologized for the latest comment, telling reporters he was sorry if his comments offended people who are suffering illnesses. That's an if. Doesn't count. Bermuda's plan to issue a new local currency with a local bird on it has become an ornithological faux pas. They put the wrong bird on the $50 bill. The red-billed tropic bird instead of the local white-tailed tropic bird. Monetary officials apologized this week for the error, but they say the red bill of the larger bird looks better against the pale yellow background than the orange of the local bird, and they won't change the note. But they did offer to dye the bills of the local birds. No, they didn't. Correction. Czech Foreign Minister Karel Schwarzenberg has apologized for the publication of a transcript of a meeting last month between French President Nicolas Sarkozy and Czech Prime Minister Mirek Topolánek. Some Czech officials have denied the authenticity of the record in which Sarkozy says, quote, do you know what it's like to stand alone against all those Arabs, to have them on the phone? They are terrible, I swear. Foreign minister has apologized for the release of the minutes of the transcript. Unfortunately, I have to admit that it probably happened at one of our offices and that it was a mistake, says the foreign minister. I assume responsibility for this. I bear all responsibility for this. First, we'll have to find out exactly what happened. Tim King, creator of the TV hit, Heroes, has apologized to fans for saying that, quote, watching the show on the air is relegated to the poor saps and morons who can't figure out how to program their DVRs, unquote. Tim King. King says he made the boneheaded faux pas while trying to explain the rise in DVR and online audience for the show, or to get attention for the show. Former President Bill Clinton apologized this week. What? No. For the impact the U.S. financial crisis is having on Canadians. At the same time, Clinton told an estimated 3,000 people in London that Canada and the United States should try and coordinate their responses to the crisis. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And the economic crisis continues apace. Of course, the car makers are going back to Washington this week, probably not in their private planes, to say, no, see, now we got a plan. Now give us the money. Citigroup, which was badmouth and Clear Channel, has got problems of its own. The Federal Reserve sprang another multi-hundred-billion-dollar thing to try to reduce mortgage rates. Peggy Noonan wrote in the Wall Street Journal, she can't see any sign of a crisis. She said, you know, stores in my neighborhood in New York still look good. Okay. It's good for New York. But it does appear that the ripples spread ever farther. We're reading about how there's a downturn in the economy in China linked to all this. And if China ever decides, gee, things are getting tight, we better not buy any more U.S. Treasury bills. Good night, everybody. So, yes, and the ripples continue to spread.
The reindeer are down to kibble, and whatever they can catch. The elves are shopping outlet stores, their shoes no longer match. The gifts are made in Vietnam, China costs too much. When he takes a gal to Applebee's, Santa's dying in Dutch. Santa Claus can't get financing, he's caught in the credit crunch. He'll fit through a lot more chimneys, 'cause the big guy's skipping lunch. Why not a bailout for Santa? He feels supremely subprime. Maybe J.P. Morgan can buy him. He's running out of time. They're grasping at straws at the House of Claus. The children are getting black and white cards instead of dolls and toys. If Santa's not careful, there'll be IOUs for the sweet little girls and boys. The ermine's been trimmed off his collars, replaced with cheap plastic foam. The North Pole's warming up anyway. It's no place like home. Santa Claus can't get financing, bankruptcy's looking good. It's loose change that he believes in as he flies through your neighborhood. How about a bailout for Santa? A few billion should do the trick. Away your hanky, just email Bernanke. Let the Fed take over Saint Nick. Let the Fed take over Saint Nick.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you live in the Seattle, Washington, or Los Angeles, California areas, this week, your chance to see the annual Harry Shearer, Judith Owen Christmas sing-along show. You'll hear that song and a lot better ones by a lot of special guests in Los Angeles, Christopher Guest and Michael McKean and Annette O'Toole joining us for the first time. And in Seattle, Julia Fordham and some other special guests. And coming soon to Chicago and New Orleans. What more can I say? Except show up. Or don't show up. That's the way with these people. They either show up or they don't show up. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude the final broadcast of the 25th year of Le Show. The program returns next week for beginning of year 26 on the same stations, on the USEN cable system in Japan, on NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, live and archive, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/leshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. By the way, if you ever have a problem with receiving Leshow at the usual place and time, check out publicradiofan.com, where you can find links to any station that's streaming it all day. And it'll be just like finally getting rid of that turkey in the fridge, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you, everybody? Thank you very much, uh-huh. My thanks to everybody who's helped with this broadcast over the past quarter century. You know who you are. Too numerous to mention. But a tip of Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. And, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and playlist of music contained hereon, as well as updates on where the Christmas show is going to be and when, and all sorts of stuff that's valuable to me, is available at the always evolving harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the... Oh, sorry, Tom.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Jones, Santa Monica, home of the homeless.
There you go.